might have been the tackiest robe in the history of robe kind. Multiple colors wavered over it in patterns like the ripples on water, but seemed random, clashing with one another. It was beaded with pearls, some of them the size of big supermarket gumballs. They put a crown-like circlet on his head after that, and then Lord Froggy and company headed out the door. I crouched as far to the side as I could, almost under the minibar, with Andy huddling right beside me, holding my veil in tight. Lord Froggy blew right by me, with the turtlenecks walking in two columns behind him, their movements precise and uniform, until one of the last pair stopped, his hand holding the door open. It was Listen. His eyes swept the room slowly, and he frowned.
"What is it?"
asked the other turtleneck.
"Do you smell something?"
Listen asked.
"Like what?"
"Perfume."
Oh, crap. I closed my eyes and focused on my suggestion frantically, adding threads of anxiety to it, trying to keep it too fine for Listen to pick up on. After a moment, the other turtleneck said,
"I've never really liked perfume. We should not be so far from the Lord."
Listen hesitated a moment more before he nodded and began to leave.
"Molly,"
said Justine's voice quite clearly from the crystal tucked into my dress.
"Miss Guard freaked out about 2 minutes ago and all but carried Marcone out of here. Security is mobilizing."
Sometimes I think my life is all about bad timing. Listen whirled around toward us at once, but Andy was faster. She bounded from the floor into a 10-foot leap and slammed against the doorway, hammering it closed with the full weight of her body. In a flickering instant, she was a naked human girl again, straining against the door as she reached up and manually snapped its locks closed. I fished the crystal out of my dress and said, "There's a bomb on the premises, down in the guest wing. I repeat, a bomb in the guest wing in the Fomor ambassador's quarters. Find Etri or one of the other Svart elves and tell them that the Fomor are planning to murder the Svart elves' guests."
"Oh my God," Justine said.
"Holy crap," chimed in Butters. Something heavy and moving fast slammed into the door from the other side, and it jumped in its frame. Andy was actually knocked back off of it a few inches, and she reset herself, pressing her shoulder against it to reinforce it. "Molly!" This was another one of those situations in which panic can get you killed. So while I wanted to scream and run around in circles, what I did was close my eyes for a moment as I released the veil and took a slow, deep breath, ordering my thoughts. First, if Froggy and the turtlenecks managed to get back into the room, they'd kill us. There were already at least 4 dead bodies in the suite. Why not add 2 more? And, all things considered, they'd probably be able to do it. So priority 1 was to keep them out of the room, at least until the Svart elves sorted things out. Second, the bomb. If that thing went off, and it was some kind of nerve agent like the Red Court used in Africa, the casualties could be in the hundreds of thousands, and would include Andy and Thomas and Justine, plus Butters and Marcy waiting outside in the car. The bomb had to be disarmed or moved to somewhere safe. Oh, and it would probably need to not be invisible for either of those things to happen. And 3, rescue Thomas. Can't forget the mission, regardless of how complicated things got. The door boomed again.
"Molly!"
Andy screamed, her fear making her voice vibrant, piercing.
"Damn it," I growled. "What would Harry do?"
If Harry were here, he would just hold the stupid door shut. His magic talents had been, like, superhero strong when it came to being able to deliver massive amounts of energy. I'm fairly sure he could have stopped a speeding locomotive, or at least a speeding semi-trailer. But my talents just didn't run to the physical. Harry had once told me that when you had one problem, you had a problem. But when you had several problems, you might also have several solutions. I stood up and dropped my wands into my hands, gripping them hard. I faced the doorway and said, "Get ready." Andy flashed me a glance.
"For what?"
"To open the door," I said, then shut it behind me.
"What?"
"Close your eyes. Go on 3, I said, and bent my knees slightly. 1. The door rattled again. 2.
"Are you insane?"
Andy demanded. 3! I screamed and sprinted for the door, lifting both wands. Andy squeezed her eyes shut and swung the door open, and I deployed the one-woman rave. Channeling the strength of my will, light and sound burst from the ends of the two wands. Not light like from a flashlight, more like the light of a small nuclear explosion. The sound wasn't loud like a scream or a small explosion or even the howl of a passing train. It was like standing on the deck of one of those old World War II battleships when they fired their big guns, a force that could stun a full-grown man and knock him on his ass. I charged ahead with a wall of sound and furious light leading the way and burst into the hall among the scattered forms of the startled, dazed turtlenecks. And then I started playing nasty. A few seconds later, the scattered turtlenecks were all on their feet again, though they looked a little disoriented and were blinking. Down the hallway, one of the turtlenecks was helping Lord Froggy to his feet, his lank hair disheveled, his robes in disarray. His ugly face was contorted in fury.
"What is happening here? Listen!"
he demanded. He was screaming at the top of his lungs. I doubt his ears were working very well.
"My lord," Listen said, "I believe this is more of the work of the Ragged Lady."
"What? Speak up, fool!"
Listen's cheek twitched once. Then he repeated himself in a shout. Froggy made a hissing sound.
"Meddling bitch," he snarled. "Break down that door and bring me her heart." "Yes, my lord," Listen said, and the turtlenecks grouped up around the door to room 8 again.
They didn't use any tools. They didn't need any. They just started kicking the door, 3 of them at a time, working in unison, driving the heels of their shoes at the wood. In 3 kicks, cracks began to form, and the door groaned. In 5, it broke and swung in loosely on its hinges.
"Kill her!"
snarled Lord Froggy, pacing closer to the broken door.
"Kill her!"
All but 2 of the turtlenecks poured into the room. From behind my renewed veil, I figured the timing was about right to discontinue my illusion just as the door bounced back after they'd rushed through it. The silver numeral 8 hanging on the door blurred and melted back into a silver numeral 6. Lord Froggy's eyes widened in sudden, startled realization. One of the turtlenecks flew back out the door to room 6 and smashed into the wall on the far side. He hit like a rag doll and flopped to the ground. There was a body-shaped outline in cracked marble and flecks of fresh blood left on the wall behind him. And from the other side of the broken door, Thomas Wraith, vampire, said,
"It's Listen, right? Wow. Did you clowns ever pick the wrong room?"
"We made a mistake," Listen said.
"Yes. Yes, you did."
And things started going crunch and thump in the room beyond. Lord Froggy hissed and swiveled his bulgy head around on his gangly neck.
"Ragged bitch," he hissed. "I know you are here."
This time, I knew exactly what Harry would do. I lifted my sonic wand and sent my voice down to the far end of the hall, behind him. "Hi there, Froggy. Is it as hard as it looks, holding up villain cliches, or does it come naturally to you?"
"You dare mock me?"
the Fomor snarled. He threw a spiraling corkscrew of deep green energy down the hall, and it hissed and left burn marks on everything it touched, ending at the doors. When it hit them, there was a snarling, crackling sound, and the green light spread across their surface in the pattern of a fisherman's net. "Hard to do anything else to a guy with a face like yours," I said, this time from directly beside him. "Did you kill those girls, or did they volunteer once they saw you with your shirt off?" The Fomor snarled and swatted at the air beside him. Then his eyes narrowed, and he started muttering and weaving his spatulate fingers in complicated patterns. I could feel the energy coming off of him at once and knew exactly what he was trying to do, unravel my veil. But I'd been playing that game with Auntie Leah for months. Lord Froggy hadn't. As his questing threads of magic spread out, I sent out whispers of my own power to barely brush them, guiding them one by one out and around the area covered by my veil. I couldn't afford to let him find me. Not like that, anyway. He wasn't thinking, and if I didn't get him to, it was entirely possible that he'd be too stupid to fool. I couldn't have him giving up and leaving, either, so when I was sure I'd compromised his seeking spell, I used the sonic wand again, this time directly above his head. This kind of thing really isn't for amateurs. Are you sure you shouldn't sit this one out and let Listen give it a shot? Lord Froggy tilted his head up and then narrowed his eyes. He lifted a hand and spat a hissing word, and fire leapt up from his fingers to engulf the ceiling above him. It took about 2 seconds for the fire alarm to go off, and another 2 before the sprinkler system kicked in. But I was back at the door to room 8 when the falling water began to dissolve my veil. Magic is a kind of energy and follows its own laws. One of those laws is that water tends to ground out active magical constructs, and my veil started melting away like it was made of cotton candy.
"Ha!"
spat the Fomor, spotting me. I saw him send a bolt of viridian light at me. I threw myself face down on the floor, and it passed over me, splashing against the door. I whipped over onto my back, just in time to raise a shield against a second bolt, and a third. My physical shields aren't great, but the Fomor's spell was pure energy, and that made it easier for me to handle. I deflected the bolts left and right, and they blasted chunks of marble the size of bricks out of the walls when they struck. Lord Froggy's eyes flared even larger and more furious that he'd missed.
"Mortal cow!"
Okay now, that stung. I mean, maybe it's a little shallow, and maybe it's a little petty, and maybe it shows a lack of character of some kind that Froggy's insult to my appearance got under my skin more effectively than attempted murder.
"Cow!"
I snarled as water from the sprinkler system started soaking me. "I rock this dress!" I dropped one of my wands and thrust my palm out at him, sending out an invisible bolt of pure memory, narrowed and focused with magic, like light passing through a magnifying glass. Sometimes you don't really remember traumatic injuries, and my memory of getting shot in the leg was pretty blurry. It hadn't hurt so much when I actually got shot, and I'd had a few things occupying my attention. Mostly, I just felt surprised, and then numb. But when they were tending the wound in the helicopter later, now, that was pain. They dug the bullet out with forceps, cleaned the site with something that burned like hell itself, and when they put the pressure bandage on it and tightened the straps, it hurt so bad that I thought I was going to die. That's what I gave to Lord Froggy, with every bit of strength I could muster. He wove a shield against the attack, but I guess he wasn't used to handling something so intangible as a memory. Even with the falling water weakening it, I felt the strike smash through his defense and sink home, and Froggy let out a sudden, high-pitched shriek. He staggered and fell heavily against the wall, clutching at his leg.
"Kill her!"
he said, his voice 2 octaves higher than it had been a moment before.
"Kill her! Kill her! Kill her!"
The remaining pair of turtlenecks in the hallway plunged toward me. A wave of fatigue from my recent efforts, especially that last one, almost held me pinned to the floor. But I scrambled to my feet, lurched to the door to room 8, and pounded against it with 1 fist.
"Andy! Andy, it's Molly! Andy, let me—"
The door jerked open, and I fell into the room. I snapped my legs up into a fetal curl, and Andy slammed the door shut behind me and hit the locks.
"What the hell, Molly?"
she demanded. Andy was soaking wet, along with everything else in the room, including the Fomor's bomb. I got up and scrambled toward it.
"I couldn't take apart the veil over the bomb from the outside," I panted. "We didn't have time to build up a fire, and I can't call up enough of my own to set off the alarms. I had to get Froggy to do it for me."
The door shuddered under more blows from the turtlenecks.
"Hold them off," I told her. "I'll disarm the bomb." "Can you do that?" Andy asked. "Piece of cake," I lied.
"Okay," Andy said. She grimaced.
"I'm going to smell like wet dog all night."
She turned to face the door in a ready position as I reached the giant shell. I forced the battering enemies at the door out of my thoughts and focused my complete attention on the shell before me. Then I extended my senses toward it and began feeling out the energy moving through it. There was a lot of energy involved in this thing, power stored up inside and ready to explode. A thin coating of enchantment lined the shell's exterior, kind of the magical equivalent of a control panel. The water was eroding it slowly, but not fast enough to start melting the core enchantment and dispersing the stored energy. But if I didn't move fast, the water would destroy the surface enchantment and make it impossible for anyone to disarm the bomb. I closed my eyes and put one hand out over the shell, like Froggy had done. I could feel the energy of the shell reaching up to my fingers, ready to respond, and I began pouring my own energy down into it, trying to feel it out. It was a straightforward spell, nothing complicated, but I didn't know what anything did. It was like having a remote control for the TV if someone had forgotten to label any of the buttons. I couldn't just start pushing them randomly. On the other hand, I couldn't not do it either. It would have to be an educated guess. On a TV remote, the power button is almost always a little apart from the others, or else somehow centered. That's what I was looking for, to turn the bomb off. I started eliminating all the portions of the spell that seemed too complex or too small, narrowing my choices bit by bit. It came down to two. If I guessed wrong, I burst out into a nervous giggle. "Hey, Andy, blue wire or red wire?" A turtleneck's foot smashed a hole in the door, and Andy whipped her head around to give me an incredulous look. "Are you fucking kidding me?" she shouted. "Blue! You always cut the blue!" Half of the door broke down and crashed to the floor. Andy blurred into her wolf form and surged forward, ripping at the first turtleneck as he tried to come in. I turned my attention back to the bomb and picked the second option. I focused my will on it. It took me a couple of tries because I was freaking terrified, and pants-wetting fear is generally not conducive to lucidity. "Hey, God," I whispered. "I know I haven't been around much lately, but if you could do me a solid here, it would be really awesome for a lot of people. Please let me be right." I cut the blue wire. Nothing happened. I felt a heavy, almost paralytic surge of relief, and then Lord Froggy hopped over two turtlenecks struggling with Andy and smashed into me. I went down hard on the marble floor, and Froggy rode me down, pinning me beneath his too gaunt body. He wrapped the fingers of one hand all the way around my neck, with room enough for them to overlap his thumb, and squeezed. He was hideously strong. My breath stopped instantly, and my head began to pound, and my vision to darken. "Little bitch," he hissed. He started punching me with his other hand. The blows landed on my left cheekbone. They should have hurt, but I think something was wrong with my brain. I registered the impact, but everything else was swallowed by the growing darkness. I could feel myself struggling, but I didn't get anywhere. Froggy was way, way stronger than he looked. My eyes weren't focusing very well, but I found myself staring down a dark tunnel toward one of the dead girls on the bedroom floor and the dark purple band of bruising around her throat. Then, the floor a few feet away rippled, and an odd-looking gray creature popped up out of it. The Svart Elf was maybe 4'6" and entirely naked. His skin was a mottled shade of gray, and his eyes were huge and entirely black. His head was a little larger than most people's, and he was bald, though his eyebrows were silvery white. He did look kind of Roswellian, only instead of being super skinny, he was built like a professional boxer, lean and strong, and he carried a short, simple sword in his hand.
"Fomor," said the Svart Elf calmly.
I recognized Mr. Etri's voice.
"One should not strike ladies."
Froggy started to say something, but then Etri's sword went snicker-snack, and the hand that was choking the life out of me was severed cleanly from the Fomor's wrist. Froggy screamed and fell away from me, spitting words and trying to summon power as he scrambled away on three limbs.
"You have violated guest right,"
Etri continued calmly. He made a gesture, and the marble beneath Lord Froggy turned suddenly liquid. Froggy sank about 3 inches, and then the floor hardened around him again. The Fomor screamed.
"You have attacked a guest under the hospitality and protection of Svartalfheim,"
he said, his tone of voice never changing. The sword swept out again and struck the nose from Froggy's face, spewing ichor everywhere and drawing even more howling. Etri stood over the fallen Fomor and looked down at him with absolutely no expression on his face.
"Have you anything to say on your own behalf?"
"No!" Froggy screamed. "You cannot do this! I have harmed none of your people!"
There was a pulse of rage from Etri so hot that I thought the falling water would burst into steam when it struck him.
"Harmed us?"
he said quietly. He glanced at the shell, and then back at Froggy with pure contempt.
"You would have used our alliance as a pretext to murder innocent thousands, making us your accomplices."
He crouched down to put his face inches from Froggy's, and said in a calm, quiet, pitiless voice,
"You have stained the honor of Svartalfheim."
"I will make payment," Froggy gabbled. "You will be compensated for your pains."
"There is but one price for your actions, Fomor, and there are no negotiations."
"No,"
Froggy protested.
"No, no!"
Etri turned away from him and surveyed the room. Andy was still in wolf form. One of the turtlenecks was bleeding out onto the marble floor, the sprinklers spreading the blood into a huge pool. The other was crouched in a corner with his arms curled around his head, covered in bleeding wounds. Andy faced him, panting, blood dripping from her reddened fangs, a steady growl bubbling in her chest. Etri turned to me and offered me his hand. I thanked him and let him pull me up to a sitting position. My throat hurt. My head hurt. My face hurt.
"It's killing me, nyuk nyuk nyuk. Come here, you."
You know you've been punched loopy when you're doing a one-person Three Stooges routine in your internal monologue.
"I apologize,"
Etri said,
"for interfering in your struggle. Please do not presume that I did so because I thought you unable to protect yourself."
My voice came out in a croak.
"It's your house and your honor that was at stake. You had the right."
The answer seemed to please him, and he inclined his head slightly.
"I further apologize for not handling this matter myself. It was not your responsibility to discover or take action against this scum's behavior."
"It was presumptuous of me," I said, "but there was little time to act."
"Your ally alerted us to the danger. You did nothing improper. Svartalfheim thanks you for your assistance in this matter. You are owed a favor."
I was about to tell him that no such thing was necessary, but I stopped myself. Etri wasn't uttering social pleasantries. This wasn't a friendly exchange. It was an audit, an accounting. I just inclined my head to him.
"Thank you, Mr. Etri."
"Of course, Miss Carpenter."
Svartalfs in security uniforms, mixed with mortal security guards, came into the room. Etri went to them and quietly gave instructions. The Fomor and his servitors were trussed up and taken from the room.
"What will happen to them?" I asked Etri.
"We will make an example of the Fomor,"
Etri said.
"What of your treaty?" I asked.
"It was never signed," he said. "Mostly because of you, Miss Carpenter. While Svartalfheim does not pay debts which were never incurred, we appreciate your role in this matter. It will be considered in the future."
"The Fomor don't deserve an honorable ally."
"It would seem not," he said.
"What about the turtlenecks?" I asked.
"What of them?"
"Will you deal with them?"
Etri just looked at me.
"Why would we?"
"They were sort of in on it," I said.
"They were property," said the Svartalf. "If a man strikes you with a hammer, it is the man who is punished. There is no reason to destroy the hammer. We care nothing for them."
"What about them?"
I asked, and nodded toward the dead girls in the Fomor's chamber.
"Do you care what happened to them?"
Etri looked at them and sighed.
"Beautiful things ought not be destroyed," he said. "But they were not our guests. We owe no one for their end, and will not answer for it."
"There is a vampire in your custody," I said. "Is there not?"
Etri regarded me for a moment and then said,
"Yes."
You owe me a favor. I wish to secure his release. He arched an eyebrow. Then he bowed slightly and said,
Come with me.
I followed Etri out of the suite and across the hall to room 6. Though the door was shattered, Etri stopped outside of it respectfully and knocked. A moment later, a female voice said,
You may enter.
We went in. It was a suite much like the Fomor's, only with way more throw pillows and plush furniture. It was a wreck. The floor was literally covered with shattered furniture, broken decor, and broken turtlenecks. Svart Alf security was already binding them and carrying them from the room. Listen walked out on his own power, his hands behind his back, one of his eyes swollen halfway shut. He gave me a steady look as he went by and said nothing. Bastard. Etri turned toward the curtained door to the suite's bedroom and spoke.
The mortal apprentice who warned us has earned a favor. She asks for the release of the vampire.
Impossible, answered the female voice. That account has been settled. Etri turned to me and shrugged.
I'm sorry.
Wait, I said. May I speak to him?
In a moment.
We waited. Thomas appeared from the doorway to the bedroom, dressed in a black terry cloth bathrobe. He'd just gotten out of the shower. Thomas was maybe a finger's width under 6 feet tall, and there wasn't an inch of his body that didn't scream sex symbol. His eyes were a shade of deep crystalline blue, and his dark hair hung to his wide shoulders. My body did what it always did around him, and started screaming at me to make babies. I ignored it. Mostly.
Molly,
he said.
Are you all right?
Nothing a bucket of aspirin won't help, I said. Are you okay? He blinked.
Why wouldn't I be?
I thought, you know, you'd been captured as a spy.
Well, sure,
he said. I thought they would, make an example of you. He blinked again.
Why would they do that?
The door to the bedroom opened again, and a female Svart Alf appeared. She looked a lot like Etri, tiny and beautiful, though she had long silver hair instead of a cue ball. She was wearing what might have been Thomas's shirt, and it hung down almost to her ankles. She had a decidedly smug look about her. Behind her, I saw several other sets of wide, dark eyes peer out of the shadowy bedchamber. Oh, I said.
Oh, you made a deal.
Thomas smirked.
It's a tough, dirty job.
And one that is not yet finished, said the female Svart Alf. You are ours until dawn.
Thomas looked from me to the bedroom and back and spread his hands.
You know how it is, Molly. Duty calls.
I said. What do you want me to tell Justine? Again, he gave me a look of near incomprehension.
The truth. What else?
Oh, thank goodness, Justine said as we were walking out. I was afraid they'd have starved him.
I blinked. Your boyfriend is banging a room full of elf girls, and you're happy about it? Justine tilted her head back and laughed.
When you're in love with an incubus, it changes your viewpoint a little, I think. It isn't as though this is something new. I know how he feels about me, and he needs to feed to be healthy. So what's the harm?
She smirked. And besides, he's always ready for more. You're a very weird person, Justine. Andy snorted and nudged me with her shoulder in a friendly way. She'd recovered her dress and the shoes she liked. Look who's talking. After everyone was safe home, I walked from Waldo's apartment to the nearest parking garage. I found a dark corner, sat down, and waited. Leah shimmered into being about 2 hours later and sat down beside me.
You tricked me, I said. You sent me in there blind.
Indeed, just as Lara did her brother, except that my agent succeeded where hers failed.
But why? Why send us in there?
The treaty with the Fomor could not be allowed to conclude, she said. If one nation agreed to neutrality with them, a dozen more would follow. The Fomor would be able to divide the others and contend with them one by one. The situation was delicate. The presence of active agents was intended to disrupt its equilibrium, to show the Fomor's true nature in a test of fire.
"Why didn't you just tell me that?" I asked.
"Because you would neither have trusted nor believed me, obviously," she said. I frowned at her.
"You should have told me anyway."
"Do not be ridiculous, child," Leah sniffed. "There was no time to humor your doubts and suspicions and theories and endless questions. Better to give you a simple prize upon which to focus. Thomas."
"How did you know I would find the bomb?"
She arched an eyebrow. "Bomb?" She shook her head. "I did not know what was happening in any specific sense, but the Fomor are betrayers. Ever have they been, ever will they be. The only question is what form their treachery will take. The Svart Elves had to be shown."
"How did you know I would discover it?"
"I did not," she said. "But I know your mentor. When it comes to meddling, to unearthing awkward truths, he has taught you exceedingly well."
She smiled.
"You have also learned his aptitude for taking orderly situations and reducing them to elemental chaos."
"Meaning what?" I demanded. Her smile was maddeningly smug.
"Meaning that I was confident that whatever happened, it would not include the smooth completion of the treaty. But you could have done everything I did."
"No, child," Leah said.
"The Svart Elves would never have asked me to be their guest at the reception. They love neatness and order. They would have known my purposes were not orderly ones."
"And they didn't know that about me?"
"They cannot judge others except by their actions," Leah said. "Hence their treaty with the Fomor, who had not yet crossed their paths. My actions have shown me to be someone who must be treated with caution. You had a clean record with them, and you are smoking hot. All is well, your city saved, and now a group of wealthy, skilled, and influential beings owes you a favor."
She paused for a moment, and then leaned toward me slightly.
"Perhaps some expression of gratitude is in order."
"From me to you?" I asked. "For that?"
"I think your evening turned out quite well," Leah said, her eyebrows raised. "Goodness, but you are a difficult child. How he manages to endure your insolence, I will never know. You probably think you have earned some sort of reward from me."
She rose and turned to go. "Wait," I said suddenly. She paused. I think my heart had stopped beating. I started shaking everywhere.
"You said that you know Harry, not knew him. No, present tense."
"Did I?"
"You said you don't know how he manages to put up with me. Manages, present tense."
"Did I?"
"Auntie," I asked her, and I could barely whisper. "Auntie, is he alive?"
Leah turned to me very slowly, and her green eyes glinted with wicked knowledge.
"I did not say that he was alive, child, and neither should you. Not yet."
I bowed my head and started crying. Or laughing. Or both. I couldn't tell. Leah didn't wait around for it. Emotional displays made her uncomfortable.
"Harry. Alive. I hadn't killed him. Best reward ever."
"Thank you, Auntie," I whispered.
"Thank you."
Cold Case. I really enjoyed writing in the previous tale from Molly's viewpoint at one of the lowest points of her life. I wanted to keep following her personal story after the events of Ghost Story, where she faces an uncertain future but is beginning to rebuild who she is and what she wants out of her life. Molly has always had issues with her mother, and now, as the new Winter Lady of the Unseelie Court, she has found herself faced with one of the more terrifying mother figures imaginable in Mab, the Queen of Air and Darkness. I wanted to get a look at that interplay, but I had to write the story to do it. I also wanted to get a little bit more into the actual role of the Winter Lady in the circles of power that are the fairy courts, and why her role is so important, and why it was so distressing that Maeve had been shirking her duties for such a long time. And finally, I wanted to show more of Molly, who has been through so much and learned such bitter lessons, and to demonstrate why it might just be possible that Mab may have bitten off more than she could chew in the inestimable Miss Carpenter.
"You understand what you must do," said Mab, the queen of air and darkness. It wasn't phrased as a question. I gripped the handrail on the side of the yacht and held on as it whumped and thumped through choppy water on the way toward a bleak shore. "I get it," I told her. "Collect the tribute from the Mixani." Mab stared at me for a long moment, and that made me uncomfortable. It takes a lot to make that happen. I mean, you should see the stares my mother can give. Charity Carpenter is terrifying, and I got to where I could shake those off like nothing.
"Lady Molly," Mab said, "regard me."
Not look at me. Oh no, not nearly dramatic enough. I looked up at her. We weren't around any mortals at the moment, but we were technically moving through the mortal world, among the Aleutians, and Mab was dressed in mortal clothing. The queen of the winter court of the Fae wore white furs and a big, poofy white hat like you might see on a northern European socialite in an old Bond movie. No mortal alive would have been wearing white heels on the frozen, dripping, bucking deck of the yacht in those seas, in the beginnings of a howling winter storm, but she was Mab. She would take the path of least resistance when practical, but her willingness to tolerate the possible alarm and outrage of the human race extended only so far. She would wear what she felt like wearing. And at the moment, it would seem that she mostly felt like wearing an expression of stern disapproval. My own clothing, I knew, disappointed her gravely, but I was used to doing that to mother figures. I was dressed in flannel-lined winter jeans and large warm boots, with several layers of sweaters, a heavy bomber jacket, and an old hunter's cap with ear flaps that folded down. Practical, sturdy, and serviceable. I didn't need them any more than Mab needed the furs, but it seemed like it would be simpler to blend in. To a point, anyway.
"Appearances matter, young lady," Mab said, her voice hard-edged. "First impressions matter."
"You never get a second chance to make a first impression," I said, rolling my eyes. I might have sounded a bit like this guy I know. Maybe a little. Mab stared at me for a long second before she gave me a wintry smile.
"Wisdom wrapped in witless defiance."
"Witless," I sputtered.
"I am offering you advice," Queen Mab said. "You have been a queen of fairy for less than a week. You would be wise to listen."
The yacht began to slow, and then slewed to one side, throwing a wave of icy spray toward the rocky shore. It handled too well to be a mortal craft, but out here, where few eyes could see, the she who piloted her were only so willing to be inconvenienced by seas that would have daunted experienced mortal captains and advanced mortal vessels. "Not mortal," I told myself sternly, in my inner, reasonable voice. "Human. Human. Just like me." "Thanks for that," I said to Mab. "Look, I get it. My predecessor hasn't performed her duties properly for, like, 200 years. I've got a huge backlog. I've got a lot of work facing me. I understand already." Mab gave me another long stare before saying,
"You do not understand."
Then she turned and walked back toward her cabin, the one that was bigger on the inside than it was on the outside.
"But you will."
I frowned after her for a second, then glanced at the thrashing 20 yards of sea between myself and the land and asked, "How am I supposed to go ashore?" Mab moved her eyes in what might have been an impatient glance, if she'd actually moved them all the way to me, and went into her cabin and shut the door behind her without a word. I was left standing on the pitching deck. I glanced up at the she piloting the yacht.
They were both male, both tall, both dark of hair and eye, which was not my type, even a little, damn it. One noticed me and met my gaze boldly, his mouth curling up into a little smirk, and my heart went pity-pat. Or something did. I mean, he was a damned attractive man. Except he's not a man. He's one of the she. He's picked a look he knows you like for his glamour, and he'd cheerfully do things with you no human could possibly be flexible enough to manage, but he wouldn't care. My reasonable voice sounded a lot like my mom's, which was more than a bit spooky. Besides, I didn't need him to care. I just needed him to look pretty while I tore his clothes off, and I shook my head and looked away, out at the ocean. Being the winter lady brought a host of challenges with it. One of the most annoying was what had happened to my libido, which had never exactly lacked for health. These days, I was like an adolescent boy bunny rabbit. Everything had sex in it, no matter how much it didn't or how hard I tried not to notice it. It was annoying, because I had a job to do. The two extremely sexy she's stared at me, being all smoldery and distracting, but not doing a damned thing to help me get ashore or prove myself on my first mission for the Queen of Air and Darkness. And since the last winter lady who had failed Mab wound up with a bullet in her skull, I figured I'd better not screw it up. Which is what she'd meant about first impressions. It had been a polite threat, and, as I realized that, my legs felt a little wobbly. Fine, then. I called upon winter. Big time. I let the endlessly empty cold fill me, subsume me, and winds rose around me as the power of winter flowed in. I let it freeze everything. My concerns of what would happen if I failed Mab, my curiosity about what was coming next, the lust inspired by the pilots, whom, I suddenly realized, had probably been placed where they had precisely to test my focus and resolve. And then I let it out. All my life, magically speaking, I had been used to being a spinner of cobwebs of illusion and mental magic. I'd always had enormous finesse and always lacked the kind of power I had seen my mentor wield. I'd forced myself to adjust to the idea that I would always have to be subtle, indirect, manipulative, that that was the magic that was mine to command. That was no longer true. There was a thunder crack that thrummed from the surface of the sea as winter's ice froze the ocean 10 feet down for half a mile in every direction. The yacht suddenly locked into place, no longer pitching and rolling. I'd have to do the math to be sure, but I thought that little trick had taken as much energy to accomplish as fairly large military-grade munitions. The two pilots just stared at me, suddenly uncertain about what they were attempting to play with. That's right, pretty boys. Mess with me, I'll hit you so hard your children will be born bruised. I gave them a sunny little smile, vaulted the side rail, and walked to shore through howling winds before the ice started breaking up again. They actually named the town Un-Alaska, Alaska. Despite the appeal of an innately oxymoronic name, Un-Alaska struck me as something closer to a colony on an alien world than as a mortal village. It's a collection of homes and businesses around Dutch Harbor, famous for being the central port for the fishing boats on that show about how dangerous it is to catch crabs. Actual crabs. Literal ones, like in the water. Sheesh, this winter mantle thing is so childish sometimes, because it's definitely not me. The buildings are all squat, sturdy, and on the small side, the better to resist massive winds and snows and rains and frozen ocean spray that turns to coatings of ice when whipped up by a storm. The town was surrounded by looming, steep, formidable mountains devoid of human markings and clung to the limited flat spaces at their feet like some kind of lichen stubbornly hanging on in the shade of a large stone. The icy sea filled whatever vision was not occupied by the sky or the mountains, cold and uncaring and implacable.
The sky overhead was a neutral gray, promising neither sunlight nor storms, yet ready to deliver both with an impartial hand and little warning. It wasn't a place that was inviting, kind, or merciful to mere humanity, and yet there they were. We were. There we were. I trudged through freezing winds and half an inch of sleet that had hardened into something between ice and snow and didn't shiver. Harry Dresden once warned me about lying to myself. I tried not to think about that too hard as I walked through the endless twilight of an Aleutian autumn and into town. I threw a glamour, nothing fancy, over myself as I went. I muddled my features from stark-boned beauty down to something much plainer. I darkened my hair, my skin, both of which were paler than usual these days. I added on a few pounds, because I'd never really recovered the weight I'd lost when I was playing grim, dark superhero on the streets of Chicago, when Harry had been mostly dead. Everything about the look said unremarkable, and I added on the barest hint of an aura that I was an awfully boring person. It would be easier to move around that way. Then I opened my senses to try to track down the elusive Fae who lived among the human population in Unalaska. The wind was kicking up, with more rain and sleet on the way, and apparently the inhabitants of Unalaska knew it. No one was on the streets, and a few cars moved about furtively, like mice getting out of the way of a predator. I sensed a trickle of quivery energy coming from one low building, a place called the Elbow Room, and I went on in. I was immediately subsumed in the energy of a crowded, raucous little dive. Music and the scent of beer, seared meat, and smoke flooded into my face, but worse were the sudden emotions that filled my head. There was drunken elation, and drunken dread, and drunken sullen anger, and drunken lust. Mainly, though, there were sober versions of all of those emotions as well. Threads of frustration and tension wove through the other emotions. Servers, I imagined, overworked and cautious. Wariness rode steadily through the room from one corner, doubtless the bouncer, and cheerful greed hummed tunelessly under the rest, doubtless from the dive's owner. I'm a wizard, and I specialize in delicate magics. I'm awfully sensitive to people's emotions, and running into this batch was like walking into a wall of none-too-clean water. It took me a moment to get my balance back, adjust, and walk inside.
"Close the door!"
someone shouted. I took note of a young man, his face reddened and chapped by frigid wind.
"Christ, I've been cold enough to freeze my balls off for days!" "That explains a whole hell of a lot, Clint,"
shouted another man from the far side of the bar, to a round of general, rough laughter. I closed the door behind me and tried to ignore the sullen, swelling anger radiating off Clint. There was something very off about his vibe. When it comes to emotions, people and monsters have a lot in common. It takes a very, very alien mind to feel emotions that are significantly different than those you'd find in human beings. And there's a vast range of them, too. Throw in mind-altering substances like hormones and drugs, and it's absolutely unreal the variety available. But I recognized an angry sexual predator when I sensed one. I faked a few shivers against the cold as I wedged myself in at the bar and nodded to the bartender, a woman who looked as if she might wrestle Kodiaks for fun on her days off, if she ever took a day off. I put down some cash, secured a beer, and felt an ugly presence crawling up my spine. I took a sip of the beer, some kind of Russian monstrosity that tasted as if it had been brewed from Stalin's sweat and escaped a Soviet gulag, and turned casually to find Clint standing behind me, about 3 inches too close and breathing a little too hard.
"I don't know you," he said.
"Wow," I said.
"What?"
"That's gotta be the best opening line in history," I said, and swigged some more beer. Hairs probably didn't start popping out on my chest, making little bing noises as they did,
but I can't swear to it. Did you want something?
I don't know you,
he repeated. His breath was coming faster, and there was a kind of glossy film on his eyes I didn't like much.
Everyone knows everyone here. You're new.
But not interested, I said, and turned away. He clamped a hand down on my shoulder, painfully hard, and spun me back around.
I'm talking to you.
Once upon a time, that sudden physicality would have made my adrenaline spike and my heart pound with apprehension. Now, my whole head suddenly went icy hot with anger instead. I felt my lips pull back from my teeth.
Oh, Pumpkin, I said, you should walk away. You aren't going to like how this one plays out. You need to come with me,
Clint said. He started to pull at me. He was strong, wobbly on his feet, but strong. Take your hand off me before I lose my temper, I said, my voice very sharp and pitched to carry to everyone in the room, even over the noise and music. And I got almost no reaction from the room at all. Now that was interesting enough to notice. Places like this were full of your usual blue-collar crowd. You wouldn't find many philosophers or intellectuals here, but there would be plenty of basically decent people who wouldn't think twice about taking a swing at an aggressor. Except no one was even looking at me. Not one eye in the entire room. Everyone was staring at a tiny TV screen on a wall, playing a sports broadcast so grainy and blurred that I couldn't even tell which game it was. Or they were focused on their drinks, or at random spots on the wall, and the whole place filled with the sudden, sour, psychic stench of fear. I turned my eyes to the two men at the bar next to me, and they only traded a look with the bartender, one that practically screamed out the words, "Oh no, not this again." What? Was Clint really that scary? Apparently. Certainly no help was coming, which meant it was up to me. Let's do this the fun way, I said. I'm going to count down from 3 to 1, and when I get to 1, if you are still touching me, I'm going to put you on a therapist's couch for the rest of your natural life.
With me,
Clint insisted, breathing harder. I'm not even sure he realized I had said anything. 3, I said.
Show you something,
Clint growled. 2, I replied, drawing out the number, the way Mary Poppins might have to unruly children.
Yeah,
Clint said.
Yeah, show you something.
What? I began to say. I didn't get to finish the word. A man seized the middle finger of Clint's hand, the one on my shoulder, snagged the other fingers with his other hand, and bent the single finger back. There was a snapping sound like a small tree branch breaking, and Clint let out a scream. The newcomer moved with calm efficiency. Before Clint could so much as turn to face him, the new guy lifted a foot and drove his heel down hard at a downward angle into the side of Clint's knee. There was a second crack, louder, and Clint dropped to the floor in a heap.
I don't think the lady likes you doing that,
the newcomer said, his voice polite. He was a little over medium height, maybe an inch or two shorter than me, and built like a gymnast, all compact muscle and whipcord. He wore nondescript clothes, much like my own, his features were darkly handsome, and his black eyes glittered with a feverish, intelligent heat. I also knew him. Carlos Ramirez was a wizard and a warden of the White Council. He was only a couple of years older than me, and hotter than a boy band bad boy's mugshot, and I instantly wanted to jump him.
Whoa, down, girl. Just because you're the Winter Lady doesn't mean you have to behave like your predecessor did. Look where it got her.
Miss, he asked me, are you all right?
Yes, fine, I said.
I apologize for that, he said. Some things just shouldn't happen. Excuse me for a moment.
And with that, Carlos reached down, snagged Clint by the back of his coat, and dragged him to the door. Clint started feebly thrashing and swatting at Carlos, but the young wizard didn't seem to notice. He dragged Clint to the door and tossed him out into the sleet. Then he shut the door again and turned back to face the room.
Everyone was staring at him. The jukebox was wailing a song about broken hearts, but the talk in the room had died completely. The fear I'd sensed earlier had ratcheted up a notch. For a frozen moment, no one moved. Then one of the customers reached for his wallet and started counting bills onto his table. Everyone else started following suit. Within 5 minutes, the place was empty except for us and the bartender.
"What the hell is this about?"
Carlos murmured, watching the last patrons depart. He looked over his shoulder at the bartender.
"Was that guy the sheriff's kid or something?"
The bartender shook her head and said, "I'm closing. You two need to leave." Carlos held up a 20 between two fingers.
"Beer first."
The bartender gave him an exasperated look, took a step to her left, and then said, "Do you understand me, mister? You need to leave. Both of you."
"That a pistol or a shotgun you got back there?"
Carlos asked. "Stick around. You'll find out," the bartender said. The fear coming off her was nauseating, a mortal dread. I shook my head and said to Carlos, "Maybe we should."
"Mostly frozen water is falling from the sky. I'm starving, and I haven't had a drink yet,"
Carlos said. He asked the bartender,
"There another place for one?"
"Charlie's," she replied instantly. "Other side of the bay. Green neon sign. Good burgers."
Carlos squinted his eyes and studied the bartender, as if weighing the value of heeding her words versus the personal pleasure he would take in being contrary. Harry Dresden has had a horrible influence on far too many people and has much to answer for.
"Okay,"
he said mildly.
"Miss, would you care to join me for a meal?"
"That would be lovely," I said. So we left and started trudging through the sleet. The sound of it hitting the ground and the sidewalks and roads was a wet rattle. I didn't need to, but I hunched my shoulders as if against the cold and dropped my chin down to my neck as much as I could.
"Goodness, this is brisk," I said.
"Is it?"
Carlos asked.
"Aren't you cold?"
"Of course I am,"
Carlos said.
"But I figured the winter lady would think this was a balmy day."
I stopped in my tracks and stared at him for a moment. He offered me a sudden, mischievous smile.
"Hi, Molly."
I tilted my head to one side. What gave it away? He gestured toward his eyelids with two fingertips.
"Seeing ointment," he said. "Cuts right through glamour. I've got eyes all over this town. When they spotted a lone young woman walking in from the far side of the island, I figured it was worth taking a peek."
"I see," I said. "Carlos, tell me something."
"What's that?"
"Do you mean to arrest me and take me before the White Council? Because that isn't going to fit into my schedule."
I'd had some issues with the White Council's laws of magic in the past, the kind of issues that would have gotten my head hacked off if Harry hadn't interceded on my behalf. But then he mostly died, and I'd been on my own, outside of his aegis. The wardens, including Carlos Ramirez, had hunted me. I'd evaded them, always moving, always watching, always afraid that one of the grim men and women in gray cloaks would step out of a tear in the fabric of reality right in front of me and smite me. I'd had a recurring nightmare about it, in fact. But they'd never caught up with me.
"Molly, please,"
Ramirez said.
"If I'd wanted to find you and take you to the council, I would have found you. Give me that much credit. I even sandbagged a couple of the ops sent to bring you in."
I frowned at him. "Why would you do that?"
"Because Harry liked you,"
he said simply.
"Because he thought it was worth sticking his neck out to help you. Besides, I had my own area to cover, and in the absence of a warden, you were giving the Fomor hell."
They hadn't been the only ones with a surplus of hell. I hadn't been having much fun either.
"Why didn't the council appoint a replacement then?"
"They tried. They couldn't get anyone to volunteer to take Dresden's place as the warden of the Midwest."
"Why not, I wonder?"
"Lots and lots of problems and not enough wardens,"
Carlos replied.
"With the Fomor going nutballs, we're up to our necks and sinking already. Plus, everyone they asked had a good opinion of Harry, and nobody wanted to inherit the enemies he'd made.
So, to clarify, I said, you're not here to bring me in.
Correct, Miss Carpenter. It would be a little awkward now that you're royalty. And frankly, I have no intention of crossing Mab if I can possibly help it. Ever.
Then why are you here? I asked. A boyish smile flickered over his face, and something inside me did a little quivering barrel roll.